DKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on February 4th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests, Mike Payette and Douglas Peerless of Geordie Theatre.
You know, such a huge component of everything that we do, not just with Geordie, but any art maker, any theatre practitioner, anybody who's in this world, interaction is huge. So, you know, it sort of underlines this sort of exponential isolation.
I think that this play and doing these great talkbacks with these kids and hearing them enjoying it and engaging with it has lifted my spirits in a way I don't think I expected when I first signed on for this kind of show.
Allison Darcy and Joseph Schrag of Scapegoat Carnival.
Who are our modern day prophets? And I think Joseph originated the idea that the artists are definitely part of that kind of prophetic scope. When we're looking at the future, often the artists have an opinion or a point of view on that.
And James McGee of At Home with James.
You know, you go from performing or teaching or doing something in the arts almost every day of the week to absolutely nothing. And it's an adjustment at first.
Before we begin, a small update. As COVID cases and hospitalization numbers dip throughout Quebec, we learned this week that there will be a gradual reopening for some parts of the province, and museums will be part of it. For most of the regions along the St. Lawrence, stores will notably reopen this Monday, and museums will be allowed to as well. In orange zones, further to the north, where there are fewer cases and fewer people, cinemas will also eventually reopen. But of course, cities like Montreal in the red zone will see other restrictions remain in place, like the 8 p.m. curfew. Just months after marking 40 years of making theater for kids and families, Geordie has launched its fourth annual theater fest this week, virtually, of course. They're making good use of the company's new virtual studio, touring hundreds of classrooms from the comfort of their headquarters in Little Italy. This week, they performed staged readings to high school classrooms, and for families, they will present two plays this Saturday, The Little Mighty Superhero and Celestial Bodies. The former is by playwright Marie Barlizzo, about a young boy on a quest for memories and friendship. It's for ages 5 and up, and Celestial Bodies for those 12 and up, features Stella, a fast-talking teen dealing with her first year of high school. Artistic director Mike Payette also directed Celestial Bodies. He joined me, as well as actor Douglas Peerless, who stars in The Little Mighty Superhero. Here's our conversation from yesterday. Good evening, Mike and Douglas. Welcome to Upstage. How are you guys feeling this week? Douglas, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you, Sarah.
Awesome. Mike, vibe check. How are you doing?
The vibes are still chill. We're good. I'm good. How are you, Sarah?
I'm so good. Thanks. I can just imagine that when you're in festival or like a gala mode, like during the week, it's just like cuckoo bananas. You've got so much to do. You know, running a company like this, Mike, when you have an event like this and it's online and it's over the span of a few days, do you still have that same adrenaline rush, that same kind of energy?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, the thing all of this shifting that's been happening in the past, you know, almost year at this point, it's not equating to less adrenaline or less anticipation or less work even remotely. And so, oh yeah, no, I still get the same sort of excitement about being able to offer something during, you know, at any point, but especially during this time. And even if it's virtual, like I'm, you know, in my home office and I'm just anticipating and making sure that I'm not muting myself or, you know, like there are different sort of concerns that keep the heart blood, you know, the heart pumping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what Jordy Theater Fest is, because your company has an interesting schedule, right? Because you've got the shows that go out into the schools, you've got programming for kids, classes for kids. There's always a lot going on. But maybe since it is the first time you're doing this virtually, let's talk about the spirit of what Jordy Theater Fest is.
Yeah, the Jordy Theater Fest, this is our fourth year doing it. It is our first virtual edition. The Jordy Theater Fest was designed to be a platform for essentially Montreal public audiences to dive deeper into various stages of developing works in theater for young audiences. And so part of that is about, you know, audiences being included in the sort of itinerary of a playwright's process in creating a new work. Some of that is also tied to the workshops that we do in between shows. And then the third part of it is actually seeing two brand new productions of our touring shows that have already been seen by thousands of kids. So it's really like an amalgamation of various stages of theater for young audiences production and development. And so one of the awesome things about this initiative so far has been the partnerships that we've made. And this is for our second year, you know, for the second year running, we've had this partnership with the National Theatre School of Canada, where we support their graduating playwrights and offer them the platform for professional actors and directors to workshop and dive into their script and then receive critical feedback from students, their target audiences, so that it informs the next stage of their dramaturgical process. And so that has been a really awesome thing. And this year, you know, we centered it to school specifically, but historically it's also been for the public. That's the biggest shift, I would say, from say last year to this year. Mm-hmm. But we're still engaging in the dialogue about TYA development, which is really cool.
Things are weird with schools this year, at least we know, because some students, there's this ongoing issue where some students in high school are in school one day, home the next. Sometimes schools have outbreaks. It's a stressful time for students, teachers, and parents. When you were setting up the readings for kids to see in schools, was there any like logistical issues that had to be ironed out as navigating our COVID world? And I'm also curious to know if this was kind of like a welcome thing to have in place, because it's so different to get to see a play, you know, as opposed to as a break from the regular classroom experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the readings themselves, in the past, we've actually rented a theater. So we are at the schools are coming to us, the students are coming to us. But this year, we're not physically going into the schools. We're offering this through live streaming. And so one of the things that we did before the season started, somewhere in June, is we opened a live streaming studio that allows us to keep our activities alive and vibrant and disseminated to the audiences that we historically reach and new audience as well. What it's done is it's actually opened up our geographical reach to even further areas, and actually having international folks part of the call or part of the reading, which has been really awesome. The actors themselves, the artists themselves, are in the same room, but we're working with a, you know, COVID health coordinator, as well as working with the restrictions and the requirements imposed, suggested by the government. But right, the students themselves are watching from the comfort of their own school or their home. What I was going to say, and that has allowed the work to still be alive, but in the most safe container that we can possibly provide during this time.
Mm-hmm. I would just imagine that if I was a student, I would be so excited to have this opportunity to see something different because of what a cuckoo year it's been so far, as for the school year itself. And we talked a little bit about the studio space being opened up a couple months ago when you were on Upstage, and hearing you talking about it again, it just feels like something from the future. I don't know why, what it is. It's a studio, it's a performance space, but it's really cool that you're able to adapt this way. And I remember, again, we talked about this months ago. It's not even the first time that you're working on this. Let's talk about The Little Mighty Superhero, which sounds like just the funnest show, and bring Douglas into the conversation as well. Douglas, tell me a little bit about this story. You're one of three performers in this play for the Geordie audience.
To start off, it is the funnest show ever. It really is a great, fun play, not just the story and getting to share it, but just as a performer, it's so energetic and starts and then almost feels like it's over in the blink of an eye, and has this through line where I can really start to see and feel, and all of us performing can really feel now after this many months in. But this show, if I had to summarize it, I would say that it's about this young boy named Max Fernandez, who I play, and he's a young 7-year-old boy. And the story is about his adventure into the underworld with his imaginary friend, Jason, so that they can get the details of a children's story that his grandmother, or his Lola, used to tell him to help him fall asleep. And he's worried that as he's growing up, he's starting to forget the story. And if that means that he has to forget about his grandmother who passed away, if he has to leave his imagination behind. So there's kind of this moral dilemma for himself of, do I stick to the story no matter what, or do I keep my imagination and my imaginary friend and have fun as a kid? What do I do? And it's a really epic story because there's a dragon, and the dragon eats the moon, and they go across like kind of the River Styx. It's a lot for a kid's show, but it's a lot of fun.
Douglas, hearing you talk about the character of Max and the story, I'm reminded of when I was a kid. I thought, you know, talking about memories and stories, I thought that every time you made a new memory, it would push an old memory out of your brain, that there's like a finite amount of space in there. Hearing about the story of Max taking on this role, was there anything from your own childhood in terms of storytelling or time with your grandparents, any memories that kind of bubbled up, you know, as you were reincarnating the role of Max?
I mean, in my own personal family history, I've been very fortunate to have all my grandparents still be around, at least the ones that I was any close with. And so I think Max's story is different from mine in that he really deals with the grief of losing a very close grandparent to him. And he starts losing those memories of her specifically. But he does have a very strong oral tradition in his family. I mean, he's really, really concerned with making sure he knows the story of his Lola. And in contrast, again, I feel like I didn't have a super strong oral tradition, but I didn't have to do a lot of grieving over my grandparents passing away. Mm-hmm. So I think the connection to the story, and especially talking with the playwright, Marie Barlizzo, she was really transparent about this story representing her son and the part of her culture that she wants to put in, of her Filipina Chinese background.
You actually moved to Montreal to take up this role, right? You were in Toronto.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What is it like to move, you know, in the crazy world we're in right now, and to come to a new city to take up work like this?
It's been strange for sure. I mean, when I moved here at the start of August, everything was kind of okay, right? At the end of the summer, you could go outside and hang out with people, and just slowly over time, getting used to being away from my girlfriend, my long-term girlfriend, and away from my friends who are in Toronto. And with the cold of Montreal on top of it, it's been a little isolating. But I will say that I think that this play and doing these great talkbacks with these kids and hearing them enjoying it and engaging with it has lifted my spirits in a way I don't think I expected when I first signed on for this kind of show. I don't have a lot of theater for young art audiences experience, but the first day when we got that screen out and we could actually talk to them and hear them and even maybe see them over video, made all of it worth it. And it because I can tell that they're engaging with it and it's making a difference to them. So yeah, I think that's been the biggest takeaway for me, is that this acting thing should really always be for the audience. And this pandemic has reminded, I think, all of us that the importance of this kind of storytelling. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. What's kind of enormous to me is that you guys have performed this over 60 times at this point.
I think over 70 now. 70? Yeah.
And so thousands of kids have seen this show, but you've mm-hmm. just been performing from the same space. How does that feel?
I've come to really enjoy it, I think, being I've really got a connection with the other two actors and with our tour manager. But when we first came in, it was so weird. I mean, because when you hear about this live stream thing with these cameras and live cutting between the shots, I sort of went into it thinking, this is going to be like a film. We're going to make a movie kind of thing. But then when we're doing the rehearsals and actually performing it, we do it like we're in a full proscenium theater, right? We need to make sure that we're playing downstage and facing the same direction and worried about sight lines and everything. But it's also not quite like theater because you're so used to that audience response, the live feed of them reacting or responding. And so it's almost like they've created a new art form that is live theater performance, but in this filmed way where as an actor, I can feel so detached from any sort of self-consciousness and worried about their opinion because they're not even there. And then we sort of bring it back down and get real and it becomes more like theater with our talk back. So it's been weird, but it's transformed the way I look at performance completely.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, well, thank Mike. I mean, I should really be thanking Mike, I guess, because this is a crazy thing. And I didn't think I'd ever be doing it still blows my mind in the show when I see out of the corner of my eye and I can see our stage manager switching between the buttons live, and that's going to some school that I'll never even visit or really even know about apart from their name and if the kids liked it. Mm-hmm. It feels huge, this play, even though it's a little three-person black box theater.
Mike, what goes through your mind when you hear that?
It makes me really proud of the work that all of the artists and all the staff and production folks at Jordy have put in to make something like this possible. But it also makes me very sad. It makes me sad because such a huge thing that such a huge component of everything that we do. Not just with Jordy, but any art maker, any theater practitioner, anybody who's in this world, interaction is huge. So, it sort of underlines this sort of exponential isolation, where you get like a dangled carrot, as it were, for like, oh, the ability to create, which is such a privilege at this point and incredibly thankful to be able to do that. But it's not the real thing. It will never be theater. And so, it will never be interactive. This format will never be that kind of interaction that that is the foundation of theater and, relationship between, story and audience. So I miss the opportunity to see the kids' faces and for, mm-hmm. For Doug and the rest of the Wasandio and Alyssa, who also make up the cast, and Rebecca, the tour manager, I miss their ability to get the profound experience that this tour gives in the realest way and in a meaningful way, to see the geography that historically this tour affords its artists. Like, all of that has been taken away or is not there. But, and that is really sad, and we're still in that, and we will be for a while. The solace, where we find light, is the fact that we know through feedback, through the questions that are asked at the talkback, through the conversations that we have with, you know, before and after with our schools and our communities, that this is working, and that there is still not just a place for this kind of work, but there's a need for this kind of work, and that there's a craving for this kind of artistic engagement and Jordy's work. And so that is why we're doing this, is because we know that this is still is incredibly valuable. And so what the live streaming does is it tries to blend both worlds as much as it can, knowing that it is virtual, but the immediacy of the actors telling the story in the moment and being streamed to the students in the moment means that the performance, the production, that time is for that audience only. And so that's a profound thing, and that I'm really grateful that we can still keep alive during this.
Well said. I want to ask you briefly about Celestial Bodies, because that is the other show that folks can live stream this weekend, and you directed it, Mike.
I did. Celestial Bodies is a beautiful, beautiful piece, a solo piece written by Jacob Margaret Archer, who is also in the West Coast, but they were living in Montreal for a good chunk of time, longer than Doug. They were actually part of last year's Jordy Theatre Festival stage reading series. And it was after that it was such a profound script that Jake had developed over their course at NTS, that it was just like a natural selection that I was like, oh no, more people have to see this. It follows the story of Stella, who's a young teenager. She is in the beginning of her school year, and not unlike many of the experiences that young teenagers, especially young teenage girls or young women at that time, they're in the throes of investigating how they are interacting with those around them. But more specifically, the relationship to their body. And so what Celestial Bodies ends up being is this one anxious girl's quest to embracing and celebrating the space that she occupies, both physically and figuratively. Like I said, it's a solo show, but there are about 8 to 9 characters that the performers weave through, whether it be Stella's crush, the weird friend that she meets in the bathroom after a bullied incident, or her mom's, one of whom is an Olympic gold medalist hockey player who becomes a very important factor to the overall story, because her friends essentially see Stella as their new potential goalie. And so it's a really funny, really heart-wrenching 45-minute journey of Stella, who's trying to weave her way through this world and, again, embracing herself within it and loving herself in a meaningful, true way.
So both Celestial Bodies and The Little Mighty Superheroes you can catch this coming weekend. What a treat to have that on the calendar. It's been so nice to speak with you, Mike, and Douglas as well. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Sarah. And be safe and stay well. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you for having us.
That was Jordy Artistic Director Mike Payette and actor Douglas Peerless. See the shows this Saturday, The Little Mighty Superhero at noon and Celestial Bodies at 5 p.m. with an ASL interpretation at 3 p.m. There are also great workshops designed for kids preceding the presentations and included with your ticket. By the way, each ticket is only $10 per household, a truly great bargain. For more information, visit jordy.ca to learn more about Jordy Theater Fest. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you are listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, what do you do when you lose your job? A question so many of us have had to find an answer to in the past year, and I'll check in with one Montreal artist who found his answer on Instagram. Now, how often have you peered into a crystal ball in the past 11 months, shared your prediction for when the vaccines will arrive, when things will return to normal, when will you set foot in a theater again? We all have a prediction for what the future holds, sometimes hopeful, other times pessimistic, sometimes both. Allison Darcy and Joseph Schrag decided to ask writers in Montreal, LA, Mexico City, and Vancouver about prophecies and to deliver short pieces that speak to that idea. Allison and Joseph are co-artistic directors of indie company Scapegoat Carnival, known for their fantastical and sometimes eccentric projects like Yev and Sapientia. Their latest series will be out in 10 days from now. It's called Soliciting Prophecy. Allison and Joseph spoke with me yesterday. Welcome, Allison and Joseph. So nice to have you both back on Upstage. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's really nice to have a chance to talk to you.
What's going through your mind here into February? It's almost a year into the pandemic, but you guys are full in on producing this really ambitious project. Why don't we start with you, Allison?
Yeah, well, this is what we call in the industry a pivot. When the industry hit, everyone was looking for ways to keep being creative when there's no audience. So this is our response to the COVID restrictions, and it just made sense that we were going to be doing a project about prophecies when it feels like it's the end of the world.
Absolutely. Joe, any opening thoughts?
Well, we're at a point right now where we've received almost all the videos, and I have to say, I'm just really pleased and excited. It's a culmination of a lot of discussions and a lot of thinking and a lot of group exercises. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So we'll talk about the project itself. What I love about it is that it poses one question. I always feel like you're off on a really good start when you can boil down all these issues, topics. There's so many different places, so many directions you can go off in, but you boil it down to one thing, which is just, what does the future hold for us? Or what do you imagine is going to happen? Can you tell me maybe the exact wording of the question you posed to these different writers and creators and why you settled on that?
Well, it's interesting that you say that it boils down to one question, because in fact, it really ended up being more on the theme of what is prophecy.
Okay.
What does it mean to be a prophet, or to see prophecy around you, or to understand prophecy as being something that is just extrapolated scientific evidence? And so who are our modern day prophets? And I think Joseph originated the idea that the artists are definitely part of that kind of prophetic scope. When we're looking at the future, often the artists have an opinion or a point of view on that. And that's what kind of led us into this idea, this theme. So all the projects are very different in terms of how they look at this idea. Some are responding to the idea of what is your, you know, what do you envision for the future? But others are, what is prophecy, or what's going to happen when the world is going to explode, and who are you going to be there with in those last moments? Like, we're coming at it from many different angles.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was inspired by the writing of Alexander Nemzer, who's a friend, and his work often engages in sort of funny and poignant ways with the Old Testament. And before the pandemic, we were having discussions about prophets, sort of old and new, and he brought up Greta Thunberg, who was described as a prophetess in shorts after she spoke at the French National Assembly. And so it's interesting because it was something that can be seen as a positive and a negative, like Q from QAnon is also referred to as a prophet. Mm-hmm. And so it just felt like there was something in the air. And when the pandemic happened, first of all our shows were canceled and we had to think of something to do. And second of all, it was really like, what, no one knew what was going to transpire in the future. So it felt kind of like it resonated in a certain way.
Yeah, it kind of is of the moment. I love that, touching on Greta Thunberg, and I think it comes up in one of the pieces, right? her kind of vision of what the climate should be or what it could be if we don't take action. And I love what you just mentioned there, touching on this. Both of you kind of mentioned that it's something that's quite old, this idea. Would you be able to maybe talk to me about, you know, how you personally are something that you've, the way you've thought about profits in the past, or what, where your brain might go automatically, like as a starting point, Allison?
I think initially I would always hearken back to the kind of religious prophets of the past that have been written about. And then also the Greek prophets that, you know, people like Cassandra who could see the future, but were never believed, you know, and people who spoke up into society, either condemning them for their behavior or trying to inspire them towards a new future. And I find that, there's a lot of that going on right now. if we were a couple of hundred years ago at this point, I think everyone would be saying that we are at the end of the world right now, and they'd be seeking out their prophets for help. And so in a way we are doing that from a much more, you know, kind of scientific and cynical point of view, but it's still happening. We still have our little prophets, and they give us hope, or they gear us into behaving in a certain way. Like Joseph said, either for the good or the bad, depending right. who you are.
Joseph, was there, besides Greta, was there anybody that you kind of had as an original prophet idea kind of before you got really into the weeds of the project, like an archetypal vision?
I guess it's funny. I think I've always had a distaste for the biblical prophets. They always struck me as being a bit self-serious and, you know, overcritical, and maybe even kind of diluted in certain ways, and I prefer and I did prefer the, you know, we worked on Oedipus a few years ago, and Tiresias and Cassandra from the tragedies appeal to me more because they're making, you know, taking courageous stances to say something difficult to people in power like Oedipus or Agamemnon, and so I think I preferred that. But then as we've done research, I've softened my position. I can really appreciate, in a way, the literary value of, like, you know, Jeremiah and internationally. I mean, so many cultures have forms of prophecy. It's just so expansive.
That was one of our really fun areas of inquisition, was discovering different forms of prophecy and different prophets throughout history in the different cultures, and really understanding how westernized our thinking is in terms of our reference points on this concept, and opening it up and understanding how many cultures embrace prophecy as just a normal part of their being and their understanding of, like, the cycle of life, as opposed to us who see it as necessarily a magical kind of external thing that only some people have the gift, or what it may be, or are touched by God, or however. Many cultures just have it built into them, and that's a fascinating way to look at it.
I'm really excited, genuinely excited by this idea of breaking out of the kind of westernized view of what one thing can be, and seeing that there's a global, there's different global perspectives. And when you presented this idea, you have 7 writers in Soliciting Prophecy, this series, and then a couple more writers in your pocket series as well. So different voices, different ideas, people living not even just in Montreal, right? Living in different places. When you presented the idea and what you were looking for, did you put any constraints, or did you nudge anybody in different directions, or did you stand back and say, like, you know, we'll just see what people come up with? How much guidance did you give?
That's a good question. It was different for different projects. For the video project, we actually created a writer's room where all of the writers got together on Zoom, of course, with us. And we had quite a few meetings where we would go through research and discuss articles and our themes and our ideas, and everyone had their own particular areas of interest, and we would explore them together. And then ultimately they started developing their pieces, and everyone started giving feedback into it. And then once they went off individually to create their pieces, Joseph and I continued a little bit of work as dramaturges, but I think it was really important for us to let everyone come to their own creative ideas really on their own, so that they could intuit the feeling of what prophecy means to them, and not be, and not have it dictated by us. And it was very important for us to have people represented from all around, and, you know, of all different backgrounds as well, so that we're not just stuck looking inside our own, you know, bubble. So for the Soliciting Prophecy series, which is the video, the digital responses, we have seven different artists from around North America, meaning Montreal, Vancouver, LA, and Mexico City. And then with the ancillary project of Pocket Prophets, which you will only be able to find on the website, there we have people from South Africa, Australia, Toronto, Montreal again. And then we also have a painting that was commissioned by a New York, Montreal artist. So yeah, we're really trying to spread our reach wide on this one.
I'm speaking with Joseph Schrag and Allison Darcy of Scapegoat Carnival Theater. Soliciting Prophecy is going to be premiering on February the 15th. And we're talking about that series right now. Why choose to, I mean, obviously you were interested in soliciting views from all over the place. We just touched on that. But when you reached out to people, were you thinking necessarily about where they were located? We're all kind of grounded, eh? Like in our hometown or wherever we are right now. Did you have in mind different regions, like when you reached out to your participants?
I think we were thinking more about how we weren't limited to Montreal. So we were trying to think of people that we wanted to work with, or people that we've worked with in the past who just don't live here anymore. Okay. So really, you know, like Gitu has been in a bunch of our shows, but she doesn't live in Montreal anymore. Alexander is someone I've worked with, but he lives in Los Angeles. So yeah, we really started with the artists, and then it just seemed like a nice touch that they were from all over the place.
Bit of a reunion of sorts.
And so, yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering, I know that there's seven different pieces to focus on in the main show. Would you be each willing to pick a favorite or pick one that intrigues you and tell us a bit about the writer and their vision?
Oh, well, it would be impossible to pick a favorite because they're all our children in many different ways. And one of the most interesting things, I think, is that while we worked on it as dramaturges, it really was their projects. So when we saw the final results, we got to be as surprised as everyone else by what their work was. So maybe instead of picking one or two, I'll give you a brief breakdown of a few of them, and maybe Joe can give you a brief breakdown of the other ones. But so we have Gitanjali Jain, who's originally from Montreal, but is also from Mexico City. And she's created this beautiful kind of childlike piece about whales and their environmental impact of their bodies and the carbon that they take in. And it's really inspired, I think, by Greta Thunberg. We have Mary Jane Gibson from LA, who used to go to school here at National Theatre School, and she's done one on psychedelics and how they can help people transition from death, from life into death, and accept many different things about their lives. We have Julie Tamiko Manning, who's a local artist, and she's doing a piece that's kind of inspired by Cassandra, the Greek prophet. But really looking at kind of women and how we're often put on pedestals and not listened to at all. So Joe, do you want to describe a few of the others?
Sure. Yeah, I'm very intrigued by Alexis Diamond's piece. She's a librettist and a translator. And it's a really, I have to say, kind of zany idea where a character named Miriam has a dream, a sort of prophetic dream, and she goes up onto the mountain and keeps seeing all these symbols from her dream and thinking this is part of some crazy prophecy called the Great Flush. And it has sort of like a very funny ending, but there's really a delirious quality that I have to admit I relate to in these times. Alexander Nemzer is doing speaking of kind of Old Testament revisions, a take on King Saul and the Witch of Endor. and gives a kind of monologue as King Saul on the night of his unraveling when he's going to find out that he's going to get defeated by David's army. But it has a very funny connection to, in a sense, the fall of Donald Trump. He kind of mixes the contemporary and the old in a very hilarious way. Who else are we forgetting?
Omari Newton. So we have Omari Newton, who is originally a Montrealer, but now lives in Vancouver. Right. And he has written a really interesting piece based around these twins who are very opposite in their way of life, sitting out the last few moments of the world together and trying to figure out how to spend that last time together, which is really fun.
And we also have Connor Wiley, who, like Omari, is based in Vancouver, Dimension in the mm-hmm. Clouds.
Yeah, Connor Wiley, he's a really interesting guy, and he's doing a piece using the game Minecraft as a kind of a generator for the images. And he's interviewed a 10-year-old boy that he knows, taken him on a bit of a meditation and let the kid carry on with a kind of giving us his vision of the future. And then Connor's somewhat animating it using Minecraft. It's a really interesting piece.
So fun. Mm-hmm. I'm really intrigued by that one and the way you've described it, and obviously the Minecraft element, but also having a child involved. But I'm also looking forward to Alexander's, because it's also described as a picture Larry David as a Trumpian King Lear. And guys, I'm just here for that kind of depiction, I think. So we're about a week away for the big reveal. You're doing an online premiere. Can you tell us what we can expect when we tune in on the 15th?
Mm-hmm. So on February 15th at 8:00, you'll be able to tune in via Facebook Watch or YouTube Live, and you'll be able to find the links for that on our website, which is www, no one says that anymore, scapegoatcarnival.com, scapegoatcarnival with an E at the end. And you can also find us on our Facebook page. And there you'll see a presentation of the 7 videos streaming together. So it's just one event of the launching of those videos. And online in the comments should be many of the artists, and as Joseph and I as well. And then after that, you can go and check out all the side projects and the pocket projects and all that on the website. And if you're not able to catch the live stream on the 15th, all the videos will be there afterwards as well. And you can catch it for the next year, because it is a bit of an installation piece.
Well, Allison and Joseph, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about Soliciting Prophecy. I cannot wait to tune in to check out these original visions. Appreciate your time.
It's really so nice much. Talking to you again. Yeah, it's good to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you. That was Allison Darcy and Joseph Schrag, co-artistic directors of Scapegoat Carnival Theater. Soliciting Prophecy premieres February 15th at 8 p.m. online at scapegoatcarnival.com. And the project attached to it, Pocket Prophecies, will also be online for the coming year. I make a bold prediction that both items will be extremely engaging and a lot of fun to take in from home. I'm Sarah DeAy. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. What do you do when your business or company closes down, especially in a pandemic? James McGee, like many Canadians, was looking for that answer this past year, and he found it on Instagram. A longtime performer on the improv and fringe scene, with characters ranging from a rock DJ to a kids' TV show host, James is also a teacher and artistic director at Montreal Improv, which formally folded a couple of months into the pandemic. When theaters physically closed down, James put together a talk show from the comfort of his St. Henry apartment. What started as a way to fill time has been polished and upgraded into a slick little show on streaming platform Twitch. And At Home with James marked its 200th show this week. I caught up with James McGee just before the big show. Good evening, James. Welcome back to Upstage on CKUT. How are you doing?
I am doing super well. I think, have I achieved a record of most appearances so far on the show?
I think so. I mean, I could say that we could scrub the slate clean when you turn to a new year, like 2021. But I'm going to say for a pandemic year, I think you have done the most repeat appearances. Ida Holmes, the artistic director, executive director at Centaur Theater, I believe would be just behind you in terms of appearances. She's had a really busy year, but there's always space for you here on Upstage, James.
Well, now I have a New Year's resolution and a goal, and that is to best her with more appearances in 2021. I know what I'm going to work towards.
You can win more.
Great.
It's crazy, but we are coming up on nearly a year of pandemic life. And I did speak with you pretty early on when things came to a screeching halt about 11 months ago, first week of March. I guess we must have spoken maybe a week or so after that. Can you tell me about what things for you have personally been like what the changes were like for you in March and April of 2020?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, you go from performing or teaching or doing something in the arts almost every day of the week to absolutely nothing. And it's an adjustment. At first, I will be totally honest in that I really enjoyed the time off. Summer felt quite bleak in the sense of continuous boredom, kind of the Groundhog Day effect. But once it became fall, I sort of fell back into relaxing into it. I feel quite lucky in the sense that it hasn't been as much of a struggle for me as it certainly has been for other people. I've tried to find ways to keep myself busy as best as possible. Other than that, though, it's been kind of smooth sailing, maybe for lack of a better term. But yeah, it certainly could be worse.
So you found a way, you know, I think everyone had a different way to handle, you know, especially if you lost employment, right? At the very beginning, everyone kind of did something differently. We joke about baking sourdough bread or, you know, Marie Kondoing your house. Those are kind of like the generic things we joke about. What made you, you know, turn from, as you were saying, doing art every day, now you can't do it. Oh, let's put on a show in the evenings.
Yeah, it was just sort of a thing that occurred to me. I was on the phone with somebody and I had mentioned how it might be interesting to try to do something using Instagram. So I had kind of conceived this idea of doing a live talk show that was at that point very, very unplanned and very thrown together. And I was doing it on Instagram Monday through Friday at 9 p.m. using the Instagram Live app. And that just spawned onto a project that refuses to end. It will not go away. We moved it over to Twitch, which is an online streaming app. And that happened in August. And we shifted from 5 days a week to 3 nights a week. And things, you know, it's been a great learning experience to shift what I was doing on some level on stage to now a online performance that is streamed out to a limitless audience, certainly always looking to grow the audience of people that are watching. But it's been a great experience. I love every second of it. It's been fun collaborating with people that I love collaborating with, but also working with people that I had never met before or had never thought to collaborate with. So it's been nothing but good times.
I think there's this, you know, like, I'm not sure what you were expecting to happen once we are all vaccinated or have herd immunity or things reopen. You know, do you feel like doing this show has kept you in good shape, in fine form for returning to performances?
Yeah, I would say that certainly if there was some type of miracle where in a month from now, people could have the freedom to get on stage and do comedy in a safe way, I would feel pretty good about jumping on stage and feeling sharp. You know, there might be some type of cobwebs to shake out, but it wouldn't be as nerve-wracking if I had kind of been inactive for a year. So the fact that I've been able to get online with other comedians and kind of work out and get reps in on some level, I think has been absolutely a benefit. And I'm really appreciative of being able to do that because it's, If I wasn't able to, I think my mindset and my temperament would be much different than it currently is.
You'd be struggling more if you didn't have this project.
I think so. I think I'd be bored out of my mind looking for an outlet, unsure of what that outlet might be. So this has been absolutely great.
I love talking to people about, you know, their mindset or how they train or work or approach different ways of doing things. So if we can talk about, you know, how different is it to go from hosting or performing in an improvised show compared to hosting on Instagram or Zoom/Twitch, you know, like from your house? Is there a different feel or a different way that you do your job?
Well, I would say that obviously, and I'm not saying anything that's going to surprise anyone here, the biggest difference is there is no immediate response from an audience. If you're on stage specifically doing comedy, if something's working, the audience is obviously indicating that it's working through their laughter and their vocal responses. Here, it's been, and it was certainly a really big adjustment in trying to get a sense of, we're doing this thing, we've got a routine, we're doing a bit, we're riffing, trying to figure out, how do we know, does this work? Is this resonating to the people that are watching? And what I've just tried to accept is, if I'm having a good time and it feels good and I can see that the other people that are doing the show with me in that given moment are having a good time, I suspect that the people watching, the audience that's watching along with us, they're having a good time too. Because there's certainly times when I walk away from a show knowing, well, that didn't work out. Things didn't hit the way that we had hoped that they would hit. I wasn't having as much fun. Things were kind of dragging along. Those are the moments that I've had to adjust and recognize, well, if it feels good, this is probably feeling good to an audience. And if it doesn't feel good for me, it probably means that we're not catching something and riding the wave with that. So there's been an adjustment, but it's been a really exciting challenge. You know, I don't want to call it broadcasting, but that seems to be the easiest kind of umbrella term for it. Something that I've always been interested in. I've had the opportunity to do a lot of hosting in terms of live audiences. So being able to transfer those skills and then adapt and acquire some new ones, it's been a really, really good time. I'm thankful for it.
I'm speaking with James McGee, host of At Home with James, and you can catch that on twitch.tv. You just look up the title, and he is live Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So it is your 200th show week or weekiversary special. What is planned exactly?
Yeah, so we've got 3 episodes to celebrate 1 episode, and I'd like to think that no one would be that foolish to commemorate 1 episode over the course of 3 episodes, but it just so happened that the week fell on episodes 199, 200, and 201. So I thought, let's turn this into a kind of a farcical celebration. What we have planned is a lot of our favorite guests coming back, and the comedians that we have on, for the most part, they're responsible for coming up with their own routines or segments. So we're going to see some things return. A lot of comedians come on and do characters. So some of my favorite characters are coming back. And then a lot of stuff, we just see what happens in the moment. I don't want to say that it's improvised. It's also not planned at the same time too. We kind of go in with a skeleton and kind of fill in the blanks as we go along. But I'm really happy about the way that things have come together so far in the week. And I'm really looking forward to the subsequent episodes.
Can you tell me about a bit or a recurring joke that you found has worked really well and why you think it has landed well with the audience?
And before I say it, I am really lucky in the sense that I get to work with a lot of really hilarious people that have come on board to help produce this show, whether it's Dave Kaufman or Carla Ma, Dimitri Kirez. They're able to make me laugh really, really hard. Dave specifically, I think, has an awareness that he's got some characters that speak to my tastes and sensibilities. Another local comedian, Carmen Rose, plays her own twin brother, and that has become a recurring segment on the show each week, and the audience that watches absolutely responds to it. Sort of a down on their luck schlub who falls into nothing but bad luck. So I think it's one of those things that when people have a comedic segment that an audience can attach to and they see a bit of humanity behind it, maybe that tends to work really well with our audience. And it certainly works well with me because I reach out to them fairly quickly after a show and say, I'm going to need you to do that character every week for the next couple weeks, or maybe for the rest of our lives.
I have to say that the Carmen Rose gag, I find hilarious. It is it is really like a notch above. So I must to keep an eye out for that. I would.
Yeah, this is the market research that yes. Carmen's twin brother, Connor, is a huge hit on the show.
Yes. So what will happen when things quote unquote get back to normal. Do you see yourself returning to the stage? Will this show continue in some way, shape, or form? Or does coming back to reality seem so far off that you haven't even pondered that?
You know what? I would say that it's a yes to all three of those things. When we're able to get on stage, I'm certainly looking forward to the day that when we're able to do that. Will this show continue on some level? I would like to think so. It's something that, you know, it's still fairly new. We've reached almost a year of episodes, but I'm new at this. I'm certainly not an expert. So continuing to learn and adapt the show, because it's already gone through kind of different iterations along the way. The more that we learn and enjoy, we try to apply that to future episodes. So I'd like to continue it on some level. I'm also realistic, or at least, you know, maybe it's not a great outlook, but, you know, cautiously pessimistic about the future and the way things are going to unfold when it comes to COVID. I don't think that this is going to shake out in the imminent future. But with that said, it's so tough to imagine the way things are going to look. So right now, this is the focus. So I'm going to keep that focus on the show. And when the time comes where it needs to change, because we go back to some semblance of a normal life, I'm of the opinion that this will exist on some level in some form, whether it's three nights a week, I'm not sure, but I think that it's something that I enjoy doing and I'd like to continue doing it with the people that I enjoy doing it with.
There's talk about a roaring 20s like we had after World War I in the last century, that people are going to be out all the time. There's going to be like kind of a renaissance maybe of arts or, you know, club life, going out, nightlife, as kind of like a joyful celebration after what we've been through. Do you think it's going to be easy for Montreal as a community, especially the English arts community, to go back into live performances and having regular shows?
You know what, I think that people are certainly going to be cautious watching the news and getting constant updates, whether it's in front of your computer, at the radio, on Twitter or other social media outlets that just bombard us with news. I think that we've kind of been scared into being concerned all the time. But I do think that after that adjustment goes away, I have a really hard time imagining Montreal not opening up and just turning into a bit of a party zone after all of this. I think that it's just going to take a little bit of time for people to reacclimate to going out, seeing live performance, seeing live comedy, live art, whatever it might be. And then I think that it's just going to be the city's going to turn it maybe into a red light district after that.
All of it, the whole island, just a red light district.
It's just going to be, yeah, it's going to be debauchery to its highest form.
So much to look forward to.
Yeah, that's the part that scares me. I'm worried about that.
Well, until then, James, we will see you on At Home with James. Congratulations on your 200th episode this week and all of the celebrations that go along with it.
The pleasure's all mine. I just appreciate being able to come on as much as I bombard you with booking requests. So thanks for everything and thanks for the support.
That was James McGee, host of At Home with James. Tune into his show Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 9 p.m. on twitch.tv. Search At Home with James. I'll be joining James tomorrow night, by the way, for his 201st show. And you have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca. Tonight, you heard Mike Payette and Douglas Peerless of Geordie Theatre, Allison Darcy and Joseph Schrag of Scapegoat Carnival, and James McGee of At Home with James. A big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under archives. Thank you to Tamara at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air, and thank you for tuning in. I want to wish Estelle Rosen a very happy birthday before I sign off. She's been with Upstage since the very beginning of this show on CKUT and recently celebrated a birthday. Happy birthday, Estelle. I hope to see you again soon. I am your host, Sarah De A. Speak with you next time on Upstage.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah. It's
kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
I'll start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay. CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio.
To the February 4th edition of Grey Matters Tonight, a lecture from Alternative Radio by Angela Davis and Astra Taylor, entitled Democracy, Theirs and Ours. It was recorded in Oakland, California, and Brooklyn, New York, on October 13th, 2020. At the end of tonight's show, we'll give you all the particulars so you can obtain a copy of tonight's show or a transcript of it. So, without further ado, here's tonight's lecture, Democracy, Theirs and Ours, with Angela Davis and Astra Taylor.
Yeah, why is it that this myth of the U.S. as the first democracy, writ large, continues to command so much attention when it was actually what you might call a democracy of the minority? What would be interesting would be to talk about the economic implications of democracy. What would an economic democracy entail? You know, what about social dimensions of democracy?
That's Angela Davis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Angela Davis and Astra Taylor on democracy, theirs and ours. The term democracy is frequently invoked, perhaps never more so than after the January 6th assault on the Capitol, which was almost unanimously described as an attack on democracy.